Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's interview.
For over 30 years, you and I have lived through a radical redistribution of wealth, upward to a tiny fraction of the population, as though we're part of a bizarre experiment to see how much inequality a democratic society can tolerate. And finally, really this past year, as a result of the Great Recession that burst the mortgage, refi, credit card bubble that had allowed too many of us to deny reality, people have woken up. And we are the 99%, the rallying cry of the Occupy movement, has spread far and wide. Today's guest, Chuck Collins, has been on the case since at least 1995, when he co-founded United for a Fair Economy to raise the profile of the inequality issue and support efforts to address it. In fact, when he did so, he was one of my first guests on this show, and we talked then about the same issues we're going to talk about today. Chuck has just come out with a new book, 99 to 1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. He paints a picture of how disparities in wealth and power play out in America and the world, and identifies the shifts in social values, political power, and economic policy that have led to our current era of extreme inequality. He also lays out the destructive cost of inequality on virtually every aspect of society. But Collins believes there's hope. And he offers proposals for closing the gap and a guide to many of the groups that are now working toward a society that works for everybody. Chuck Collins is a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, and he directs IPS's program on inequality and the common good. He's co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good, a network of business leaders and high-income households working together to promote shared prosperity and fair taxation. As I said, in 95, he co-founded United for a Fair Economy, and he was executive director there from 95 to 2001 and program director until 2005. He's co-author with Felice Yeskel of Economic Apartheid in America, a primer on economic inequality and insecurity, co-author with Bill Gates Sr. on Wealth and Our Commonwealth, and author, as I said, of the just-published 99 to 1. Welcome, Chuck Collins.
Great to be with you.
Yeah, it's funny. When I saw you come out with this book and thought, okay, let's schedule them. I went back and checked my records, and you were one of my very first guests in 95.
Wow, and you've been at it. It's great.
We've both been
really
at
good
it.
Conversations. I've heard.
Yeah, thank shows. You. Yeah. Thank you. Now, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we're going to talk about. So, if you could briefly talk about your path to the work that you're doing today, and feel free to mention mentors or turning points or moments of decision.
Well, one thing that's relevant to this book is actually I grew up in the 1%. I'm the great-grandson of the meatpacker Oscar Mayer. So my dad used to say, that means bringing home the bacon has a whole different meaning to our family. But I basically, grew up, as many privileged people do, in sort of a bubble. I thought, this is how the world lived till I was probably 12. Although one thing did break that for me, which was in 1967, the Detroit riots. Grew up in the suburbs of Detroit initially. And that's when I think I started to talk to my parents about inequality. I started to understand both race and class disparities and that at the root of that uprising was this deep discontent about inequality.
And how old are you at that point?
I was only 7.
Oh, okay.
And I continued to live my bubble life. But for what it's worth, I also went to the same school as Mitt Romney. I went to high school to a school called Cranbrook School, where our school motto of our little prep school was aim high.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he's aiming very high, and yep. I'm aiming as high as he is trying to deal with these inequality issues.
Exactly.
So when I talk about the 1%, it's not really, I don't actually think of the 1% in a very monolithic sort of caricature or cartoonish way. I actually know the 1%, know people, know that there's allies to be won over there. As well as there's some diabolically evil people who use their wealth and power to rule the world and wreck it for the rest of us. So that's the perspective I bring.
Well, that's from your earliest. At what point, what were you doing up until 95 when you said, okay, this is where I've got to put my heart, my work?
I worked for over 10 years doing community development work. I worked with tenants trying to buy their buildings. I worked with mobile home park residents in the Northeast United States trying to buy their mobile home parks. And it was a really interesting window into the economics of people's lives. For example, I worked with a mobile home park that had about 80 residents. And we were trying to figure out if they had the resources to buy the park, buy the land on which their mobile homes were. And I did all the financials. I had all the confidential information. I sort of did the spreadsheets and entered everybody's individual data. How much was their income? How much did they have for savings? What could they afford to pay toward buying the park. And it was a huge window into really just how poor people are, you know, again, coming from a privileged background and saying, wow, these people live, they live well, but they have to depend on one another in ways
Am I guessing that as you looked at them, as you worked with them at that point, you didn't realize the disparity was as great as it was as when you looked at their numbers?
I didn't. It was illuminating.
Wow.
And yet, at that same time, was really early 80s. It was really at the beginning of the new pulling apart, the kind of pulling apart in inequality. So I kind of experienced that first decade of extreme inequality by looking at the very personal finances of the people I was working with and seeing, oh, what is the impact of stagnant wages and debt and people being forced to work more hours and take on second jobs just to sort of pay the bills. So it's obviously not a revelation for most of your listeners, but for someone who grew up in the 1%, that was my tutoring, that was my education.
Right. And then in 95 you said, this is where the work has to be?
Actually, yeah, and for a couple of years before that I worked on a state coalition on tax fairness in Massachusetts. And so we worked to try to address the problems in the tax code, the unfairness of the state tax code. But it was at that time that a woman, Felicia Skell, and I teamed up and started United for a Fair Economy. And she came from a totally different class background. She was, you know, working class, raised in New York, Jewish, lesbian, feminist, and I was like the Christian owning class kid. But together, we totally hit it off and worked together, and that was part of the energy of United for a Fair Economy. We just said, hey, look, these inequalities are hurting everybody, and we have to do something about it.
One thing I want to ask you, and I'm afraid if I dig right into the details, I'll forget, is, as I point out, you've been at this for a while. This is, the We Are the 99% is probably just a year old. The notion of inequality as an issue that a president would talk about is less than a year old, following the emergence of the consciousness in the popular world. But you've been looking at it, we're talking 17 years. Just share a little bit about how that has looked to you.
Well, it's been, there have been dark days where I sort of thought, wow, maybe we're not approaching this the right way, or maybe it's not breaking through, or maybe even talking about wealth inequality isn't the right frame. You know, lots of people are always telling you you're doing things wrong, and you should do it this way. But, it's a little bit like chipping away, saying, look, if people understood that these inequalities really deeply affect everything we care about, you know, and are undermining the quality of life and excellence for everybody in this country and in the planet. That if we sort of keep repeating that mantra or particular way of looking at things, that
frame,
that it will emerge. And I guess I've always had a certain trust that that part of what changes history are social movements and people waking up and taking action, and that there's lots of preparation that goes into it. There aren't these things just don't sort of pop up. Rosa Parks just doesn't get tired and sit down on the bus. There's all kinds of preparation and training and leadership development and people coming to an understanding. And so it was very heartening in the fall to see that We Are the 99% and the 1%. We'd actually started a project 2 years earlier called The Other 98%, which is an online organizing thing that has 150,000 Facebook friends and does stuff on inequality. So we were just off by one number, you know.
Yeah.
But so all these, you know, these things are the social movements come from many streams, and it was also heartening for me to see younger people stepping up and taking leadership and knowing that, you know, I personally didn't have to sleep in a tent, but there were people willing to do that, and that all of us have a part to play. So it's exciting, and its time has come, you know.
The other thing I will point out is that as we talk towards the end of this more about the solutions and so on, you really do view it as a generation, at least. This is that it's going to take. You hearken back to the reforms in the early 20th century.
Yes, we did live through a period 100 years ago of extreme inequality, as we are today, and we as a nation reversed those trends. So it's possible. It took a generation for them to reverse the inequalities of 1910, 1915, through policies that break up concentrated wealth and corporate power, as well as expand opportunity. We don't have that same amount of time this time around for various reasons we can talk about, but I do think we the last 30 years, we have lived through a pulling apart. We've lived through this period of extreme inequality. But the underlying conditions, the young people with huge amounts of debt, people seeing their middle-class dreams collapse, many people feeling trapped in poverty with no way out, those underlying conditions aren't going to change. We might be distracted or deflected or convinced it's caused by something else, but the underlying conditions that are giving rise to this movement will not go away until they're addressed.
Well, in a way, I've heard you say that before, and I thought to myself, well, that's the good news and the bad news. In other words, we would like the conditions to go away, but the fact that they're not without enormous effort and political action and social movement and so on means, but you're saying the good news about that is that the pressure will build. The pressure will build.
That's right.
How did this book happen? And let me just say to people, the book, 99 to 1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. What I like about it, first of all, basically 124 pages of text. So pick it up, and it's not an inflated set of academic ideas. I mean, it's really pretty much cut to the point. It's almost a fleshed out outline, with not using that as a negative term. I mean, it just cuts to the facts.
Well, I'm glad you feel that way, because that's what we set out to do. And it was really in October that Barrett Kohler Publishing from San Francisco said, hey, you want to do a book on inequality? You want to do it in a month?
Well, and they did This Changes Everything, the Yes Magazine book on the Occupy 99% movement, at about the same time, at about the same pace.
That's right. Actually, once we got into the discussion, they said, oh, well, let's take a little bit longer. Let's tee it up, you know, from a distribution point of view better, which I'm thankful for. But they were great. They've been great to work with. And the goal really is, you know, in a culture now where very few people read books, is to offer up something that could be of use to these emerging movements and answer the questions like, who is this 1% and how do they wield power? And, you know, most important, what's the way forward? What's the program that will move us forward?
One other thing I want to mention to listeners at this point is, it seems to me, as I said, this is the 124 pages. It's got the facts. It's got the, you know, I often use, when I'm thinking about something, three questions, and I call it, it's broke, let's fix it. Is it broken? What's the evidence? That's in here. How did it get broken? What's the history? That's in here. And then how do we fix it? And that's in here. And that's what you do. I wanted to refer for people to a couple of books that I think, and I want to ask you the same question, a couple of books that I think lay a foundation for two of the points here. One is The Spirit Level by Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett, which I will actually quote in the course of this interview. But The Spirit Level, a book that lays out 30 years of research that makes the facts of how inequality hurts everyone. Say just a little bit about that book.
Well, it's an incredibly important book, written by epidemiologists from England, Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett, his partner, that looks at, you know, how inequality makes us sick, how it undermines excellence, how it wrecks our sort of sense of happiness. It's really pulling all the kind of medical and sociological evidence about how unequal societies perform badly on a number of really important indicators. And I would argue it's part of this growing... you could have an inequality studies department at a university now looking at biology, ecology, economic functioning, sociology, health.
Interesting.
I mean, these inequalities cut across discipline. Sports. How is wealth inequality wrecked sports? Now we live in these sort of gladiator sports where, you know, if you're a young person, someday you might hope to go see your team play in their stadium, but the box seat skybox people have taken over and the big money's wrecked everything. Slight aside, but I was in Ireland last summer visiting friends in the Gaelic Athletic Association is an amateur sports association that every boy and girl is a member of a club in their community, and they all dream of playing in Croke Park, which is a non-profit-owned stadium, which is where the center of sport happens in Ireland. Big money has not wrecked sport. Sport is part of our culture. It shouldn't be trashed and taken away and professionalized.
We're talking about this when the Dodgers were bought for $2 billion recently by a member of the 1% who had basically pilfered from them, you know. And I know what you're saying. It's absolutely, absolutely true that in the old days, sports were a great equalizer. Not so much anymore. I'm going to read just a little bit from Spirit Level, and then we'll pick up. Wilkinson and Pickett show conclusively that the well-being of whole societies, you are worse off if you are rich in an unequal society than if you were that same rich in a more equal society. And I think that's an interesting point. But it's correlated not with average income, but rather with the size of the disparity of income between the top 20 and the bottom 20. In the most unequal countries, the wealthiest are less healthy and happy than their counterparts in more equal ones. Not only that, they've applied their research to the U.S. and found that findings are true comparing the 50 states. If you are from a state with greater inequality, and here's some of the things. Health and social problems are worse in more unequal countries. And the U.S. is basically off the charts in both income inequality and health and social problems. Prevalence of mental illness, U.S., by far the most mental illness and the most inequality. While not as extreme, the relationship holds true for child well-being, illegal drug use, life expectancy, infant mortality, obesity, educational scores, dropout rates, teen pregnancy, birth rates, homicide, rates of imprisonment, social mobility. One that America, you always said you were more socially mobile here, not true anymore. CO2 emissions, rates of innovation and patents. And that's another one that if you asked people, say, no, America, sure, we got our problems, but we're still tops in that. Not true. The rates of innovation and patents also correlates with inequality, rates of recycling, and levels of community trust.
Just say one thing about that.
Yes.
Underlying what they document is what they call a breakdown in solidarity. That societies that have more equality, people see themselves in the same boat, and they do say, an injury to you is an injury to me. The more you pull apart and stretch that disparity, the more it's like you're living in another universe. And what happens in my neighborhood and what happens in your neighborhood, it doesn't really affect me. And so I can live in a neighborhood where 2 miles away children are dying of gun violence, but I'm buffered and I think I'm in another world. So that, and then I stop having a stake in the well-being
of
the whole culture.
One of the things I hear is that the very nature of democratic does not mean elections, right? Democratic means something about the common good. And, I mean, as I said in the intro, you know, an experiment in how much inequality can a democratic society tolerate. In some sense, it becomes less democratic in all the ways that matter. Before it shows up at the election booth.
Yeah.
I'm Terrence McNally, speaking with Chuck Collins about his new book, 99-1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. You can learn more at inequality.org. This is Free Forum on KPFK. Another book I just want you to mention, and then I want to ask if you have something you'd add, because I think if someone gets excited here, I want them, is Winner Take All Politics by Hacker and Pearson, which is, to me, the big book of how this happened, how it got broken. You want to say anything about that one?
Well, I think in some ways it says something that probably is common sense. The more concentrated wealth we have, the more wealth and that wealth is power, and power to influence the outcomes in a political system. So whether it's the congressional elections or the rule writing process, we basically now have seen the rules of the economy skewed to benefit the 1%, and you have this sort of cycle, if you will.
Feedback loops that feed on themselves.
It's a feedback loop where the more wealth and power concentrates, the more they use their wealth and power to rig the rules, the more wealth and power concentrates, the less the quality of life, the worse it gets for the 99%. So that's sort of the unfortunate dynamic that's documented in Winner Take All.
Yeah, and what they, two things that lead to they say lead to that book is, one, we actually got better information than we'd ever had. We used to look at the 1%, but we didn't used to break down statistics to the 1/10 of 1%, the 1/100 of 1%, and so on. And so with the, you know, a lot more information technology and so on, we started getting more information. And the more information you look at, you see the concentration gets worse and worse and worse the higher you go. And then that led them then to ask, you know, how has it really happened? And one thing you see in that is that the U.S., has actually, in some ways, the way that it has responded to changes in the global economy has been much more regressive than a lot of other nations, and something that people here don't look at and used to get, you know, that whole thing that we haven't even mentioned yet here, but the poo-pooing of even examining this as class warfare. As if that's what's breaking the democratic solidarity is talking about it.
Envy.
Yeah.
As if envy was our problem as opposed to these underlying inequalities. Yeah.
So that first question, what's the evidence that it's broken? You know, at this point, there are people who probably go, look, I know it's true, but some of the statistics that you lay out and that are very, very available on inequality.org just make the point in a way that it may be worse than you think.
Yeah. You know, I think that the thing that's sort of dizzying is how wealth has and income have concentrated in a fairly short time, in really a 30-year, in a generation span. So in the 1970s, the richest 1%, it had 20-something percent of all the wealth. Now they have 36%.
That's almost double in 30 years.
That's right. And that's,
you know, you're saying the 1%.
The 1%, the richest 1%. To join the 1% today, you know, you're talking about incomes over $500,000, wealth over 4 or 5 million. So it's a fairly elite group of, you know.
And if we have a population of 15 million, then we're basically talking a little more than 3 million is what that, who that 1% is.
Say 1.5 million households have this huge.
That's who we're talking about. We talk about.
And what does that mean? Translate. Well, prior to the economic meltdown, I estimated it was about $20 trillion owned by the richest 1%.
Equal to the amount owned by?
Well, it's more than the wealth owned by certainly the bottom 80%,
okay,
95%, I'm sorry.
1% owns more than the 95%.
Absolutely, yeah. And in terms of income, in 1979, the richest 1% captured 9% of the income, the total income. Today, it's 21%.
Again, doubled.
So, yeah, the gap between average CEO and average worker was about 42-1 in 1980.
As it now, is in many other countries.
And it's stayed there in other countries at that level. In the United States, it's over 350-1.
Right. And when you get to around 350, think about it. There's 365 days in a year. That means that guy makes in one day what his average worker makes in the whole year.
And, you know, that this is a fairly short time, you know, for those kind of what typically are kind of glacial shifts to happen. It can only happen through aggressive rule rigging in the economy. And then on the corporation side, you can sort of see, oh, well, there's a couple thousand corporations now that for whom the corporate income tax is almost voluntary, or they receive so many subsidies that they're actually beneficiaries of the public treasury. They don't pay into it. So you have companies like General Electric and Boeing and Pfizer, drug company, and Apple, even Apple Computer, that play all kinds of games with their taxes using the offshore system, which is these 100 or so secrecy jurisdictions like the Cayman Islands and the Isle of Man and places in Bermuda where corporations can register and avoid transparency and accountability. And you asked about a book I did. There's a great book called Treasure Islands.
Oh, don't know this one.
By a British guy named Nicholas Shaxson, treasureislands.org. You can learn about it. I used to think that the offshore system was a sort of sideshow curiosity. Oh, that's too bad we're losing this money. Now I understand actually it's a very key central piece of what's broken, which is it allows corporations to basically operate without any accountability. They're accountability-free zones. Not only are they avoiding taxes, they're extracting mineral and wealth from the global south, and they're avoiding regulation. So AIG, the insurance giant, their subsidiary in the City of London was where all the shenanigans happened. The City of London is a tax haven within England. It's a special secrecy jurisdiction. I didn't know all this stuff until I read Nick Shaxson's book. Africa, every $10 of aid that goes in from foreign countries, aid to Africa, probably $100 comes out, extracted by multinational companies and wealthy elites from those countries, shifting their income and assets offshore into secrecy jurisdictions.
And by the way, one of the strategies that certainly wasn't readily apparent to me until I learned about it is that one of the ways they do this, you think, oh, they're just putting money in bank accounts over there. No, one of the things they do is that in this modern knowledge economy, the most valuable thing might be your patents. It might be the way you do certain things. It is your intellectual property. So what these companies do is they sell the intellectual property, the patent on that Apple product, the patent on that new phone, to some subsidiary in the Cayman Islands or somewhere, and then they put the manufacturing, the dull old world stuff stays here. Right?
Absolutely. And so drug companies, knowledge-based companies are big users of the offshore ownership of intellectual property. Ireland, the Netherlands, the Bermuda, all. And these are nations that have very low or no taxes on intellectual property revenue. So Apple can sell an iPod here and pay their own subsidiary for the intellectual property and reduce their taxes here. And these are the games that a few thousand global companies get to play.
And these are the things that people have to know about, and that I do think there's political currency that once people know, if we can keep attention on this, once people know this, it, I think, revolts many, many people who would maybe consider themselves conservatives, but would still be upset about this sort of thing. Okay, so that's the evidence that the system's broken. And then the how did it get broken, we've talked about that somewhat. A concerted effort started 30 years ago, started basically in the Reagan era. There was some deregulation in the Carter administration, too. When you go back, you read Scheer's book, yes. The Great American Stick-Up. He goes all the way back to Carter and then focuses a lot on Clinton. He's very equal opportunity. But basically, one of the things I was thinking that you don't mention in your book, but that concerted effort that they have made, that the right and the business community, that part of the business community has made, to change the justice in this country, to put in place federal judges, et cetera, very long term, very patient kind of process. You want to speak to that at all?
No, I think that I think that coming out of the shared prosperity years of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. These architects of a new economic order really took a long view, you know, getting chairs in economics departments and endowing, you know, departments of research and creating a whole kind of constellation of think tanks to promote ideas that have huge dissemination and communications budgets. And, you know, there was a lot of good organizing, if you will, to kind of shift the conversation. And it played into value shifts that were happening. I mean, we were moving from the we're in it together sort of culture after World War II to a you're on your own sort of values frame. And they built that and promoted it. Everybody is their own king and consumer, and you don't need to rely on your extended kinship network on your neighbors anymore. You want to, you know, show your self-sufficiency and get out there and grow your wealth and opportunity on your own. And so there was a lot of, I guess, breaking down of some of the social fabric and an unraveling of the social networks that sustained many, many people and communities.
Yeah, one of the things you talk about is in a chapter called Reversing the Inequality Death Spiral, which is where you sort of turn the corner in the book, is that the power of the dominant values and social messages, the dominant stories of the last three decades. You have this list on page 91 of the book on dominant stories of the last three decades. I'll start while you find the page. You are on your own. Look out for number one. Consume without regard to the earth or others. Do whatever you want. The sooner the better. Tough luck if you can't keep up. Everything will work out if we each pursue our individual self-interest, and people are located along the economic ladder based on merit and deservedness. In other words, the rich deserve it. What you're saying is that the stories of we got through the Depression together, we fought World War II together, we're in this together. Kevin Phillips would probably say that the civil rights movement created the break, the Vietnam student movement created a break, and then that break was seized on.
That's an interesting perspective. I mean, I think that within U.S. culture, these individualistic threads, as well as the sort of community or communitarian threads, exist side by side, so that we can each embrace them, even be contradictory inside ourselves. We can say, individual effort matters. You know, my getting up and my effort is a supreme driver of whatever has happened in my life. At the same time, you can say, however, I would be nothing without this environment, without the society, the community from which I come from, without the fertile ground of generations of investment and infrastructure that make it possible for me to think I'm so bright and individually achieving. You know, so both these things are true. Both of these complexities we hold. What I think happened is that it was almost like one brand subsumed the other. You know, like the individual brand just like crowded out the web of supports. We stopped looking in the mirror and seeing each of us as individuals part of a web, an individual in community, and we just saw ourselves as individuals.
Yeah.
And I think there's a way in which, you know, the business press promoted that. They'd say, Terrence, tell us what values did you personally bring to your successful enterprise? And you would start off with the word I. Well, I,
yeah,
blah,
blah, yeah.
As opposed to saying, Terrence, from what traditions did you emerge, and from what influences and mentors enabled you to be who you are? You know, and you would start to that story with a we. You know?
Yeah, it's that great Elizabeth Warren comment about, you know, so you had a great idea, so you opened a factory. you know.
Blessings
good for you.
Upon you.
Right.
Yeah.
But the road to get there, the educated people you're able to hire, all of that, you depend on those around you. It's interesting. I'll just throw this out to you. There's a book by Will Hutton, a Brit, Declaration of Interdependence. You know the book. He says an interesting thing. He says that individualist strain is stronger in us because when Enlightenment came to Europe, the property had already all been divided. So you couldn't say an individual was his property. He was himself, his rights, his beliefs, and so on. The U.S., hardly a U.S. at the time, but this America, the property had yet to fully be confiscated from the native peoples. And so there was this idea of an individual and his 40 acres and a mule, an individual linked to property. He says he thinks that the strain started there. But it's in the last 30 years that it really got revved up. I think suburbia, nuclear family, all of those things that we didn't see as having the seed of destruction in them,
yeah.
But I think they made people much more able to begin to feel alone.
Yeah, the breakdown of the sort of extended family, the tribe, the sense of
the neighborhood.
I'm not just mom and dad, but there's this web out there. There's another terrific book, by the way, I'll just flag, from our friends at United for a Fair Economy called Self-Made Myth.
Ah!
And Brian Miller and Mike Lapham have done a terrific job. They've interviewed entrepreneurs who tell their story through the lens of how society helped them, thereby kind of unpacking some of these mythologies of deservedness and I did it alone,
yeah.
You know, beat your own. You know, it's not to say that individual effort isn't important. It's hugely important. But it really, you know, it's like planting, you want to plant your seed on a rock or you want to plant it in a garden.
Exactly. Know? Exactly. So you do make a distinction among the 1%. Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, having grown up in the 1%, I want people to understand my people, if you will. No. But you know, within the 1%, there's actually a not insignificant percentage of people who actually work and devote their lives to an economy that works for everybody, who care about education and the environment and are engaged. The problem is within the 1%, you have a subset, I call them the rule riggers or the game fixers. They use their wealth and power to rig the rules and fix the game in their favor. They're like the Koch brothers or people like that who actively, aggressively use their philanthropy, use their foundation, their charitable foundations, use their social networks, use all the tools that we all have at our disposal, but they use them to advance this very narrow agenda that will expand their own wealth at the expense of everyone else. And those are the folks we have to defend ourselves from. And they form alliances or overlap with Wall Street or with these large mega corporations. So it's really sort of this 1% segment of the 1% teaming up with CEOs and some Wall Street robber barons that are running things, have tremendous wealth and tools at their disposal, including media ownership. And
one of the things that strikes me is that the Chamber of Commerce is a player right in the middle of all this. And I'm early 60s. The Chamber of Commerce image 20 years ago, 30 years ago, it was the plumber, the realtor, the restaurant. In it was Main Street.
Yeah.
And now, same name, still taking dues from those people, but it's really become a very different entity, hasn't it?
It has. I mean, and it's important to make a distinction between, say, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which has really been captured by a couple hundred mega global companies, and local chambers of commerce, which tend to still be like Rotarians and Main Street business.
Yeah.
Now, here in California, your state chamber of commerce looks pretty captured by the big boys, but there's still, you know, they don't hold all the cards, I guess. It's important to realize, like, that little segment of the 1% and these, they are powerful. They have huge communications apparatuses. They have teams and armies of media spokespeople and pitchers and all that stuff, you know. But they don't hold all the cards. And they're actually small numerically. So if you put the 99% together with some allies in the 1%, you actually can start to push back in significant ways, and that's where I think we're going.
One of the things that I also notice is you do, when you talk about the 1% and 99%, you also break it down, as you were just doing, in terms of business. I think this is left out of most conversations. So small businesses also fall into the 99%, and in working on your book and looking at this issue, is there a dawning awareness among small businesses that they are likewise getting the shaft from the 1% of corporations?
Yes, there's now kind of more and more small businesses that are saying, wow, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce does not speak for me. Even the National Federation of Independent Businesses, NFIB, has been captured by the big boys. They're no longer really, they're really a sort of a arm of the Republican conservative agenda. So there's now whole new networks, the American Sustainable Business Council, the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. I mean, those two networks alone represent probably 100,000 businesses. And I think it's important to spell out a very simple distinction. I like simple. You got these 99% of small businesses, even some larger businesses and national companies that are anchored and rooted in localities that are making real goods and services, that, and they're in it for the long term. They're what the journalist Jim Collins calls built-to-last companies. They recognize that they have stakeholders, customers, communities from which where they operate, employees who they should treat well. They are, in a sense, accountable because they're rooted and anchored in a locality. But then you have this couple thousand global companies that now salute no flag, salute no community, don't pay their dues. Their business model is what I call built to loot. Their whole business model is, how do we shift costs off of our balance sheet? How do we get other people to pay our taxes? Actually, how do we get you as taxpayers to give us money, subsidize us? How do we get our labor costs down to nothing by outsourcing and laying off and mechanizing? How do we treat our pollution and externalities? Oh, let's get society to pick up after us. So that's their business model. And they're out there calling themselves job creators and lobbying, you know, like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has this big banner on the side of their building that says jobs. And every time I look at it, I'm like, come on, you know. You guys are in the job destruction business. Don't even pretend. Your whole business model, every time you lay off workers, the Wall Street roars in approval, you know. Your whole business model is about short term, take the money and run. So I think we shouldn't lump them all together. We should look for and invite the small business sector and allies to join this movement.
Yes. A lot of those small businesses may be owned and founded and run by folks who have an individualistic streak, because, you know, in they had it in high school, they had it in college, they're entrepreneurial and so on. But this making alliances and pulling in those people, I think, is going to be a very, very necessary shift if these movements are to be successful.
I mean, I think here in California, after these, you know, a couple of years of devastating budget cuts, you have small businesses that now understand, whoa, we need to basically not disinvest the common wheel, the treasurer, the infrastructure, the education system. Where are we going here? And I think in the next year, there's really important alliances to be made, say, around this ballot initiative to raise taxes on millionaires, that there should be a very small, aggressive, small outreach to small businesses who, by the way, most of them are what are called Chapter S companies. They don't pay those kinds of taxes until they take the money out of the company and put it in their own bank account. If they need to make reinvestments in the company to expand and hire new people, there's no disincentive for them to do that in this
current
tax system.
Even if there were higher corporate tax.
Exactly. They don't pay the corporate tax. They pay the Chapter S federal income tax. So it's a huge accounting myth, you know, that this is going to be bad for business. This is going to hurt small business.
Yeah. I mean, this whole thing of, yes, what's bad for business, who are the job creators, those frames, those stories, I think it's a slow, a very gradual education campaign, and it has to be done with an arm outstretched, if you will, with an openness that means conversations maybe with people you wouldn't otherwise talk to.
Yeah. No, I agree. And, you know, the good news is there's a network, the Business for Shared Prosperity, the American Sustainable Business Council. You'll see sort of in their frame an understanding is, hey, we're in this for the long haul. And these other companies are the looters. And they're destroying the business environment. They're wrecking the private market. They're putting their huge thumb on the scale and distorting the functioning of a healthy capitalism.
One of the things that I noticed along the way that's a little slightly different than this, but very much akin to it, is let's say you're making landfill regulations, just as an example. What you will see is that the big, the waste managements and the I think, what is it, BMI, these big companies will fight regulation until they realize it's inevitable. Then they will write it. And they will write it in such a way that only the big company can afford to meet the regulation. And I think that happens across the board.
It happens in every sector.
Yeah.
Food safety, everything. You know?
Yeah.
Fight regulation. And my friend Peter Dreyer has a little book coming out called The Crying Wolf, looking at 100 years of regulation and how every time, you know, oh, if we pass this seatbelt law, you know, this will be the end of Western civilization and it'll end, you know, blah, blah. You know, it's like every time there's a regulation proposed. But now we're living in a time when these huge couple thousand corporations have captured our government and have captured the rule writing and regulation process, and so the rules tend to tip their way.
By the way,
against the interest of small business.
Are you aware of Tom Lindsay's work?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. In other words, that's a, you know, we don't have time to go into it, but Google Tom Lindsay, L-A-N-Z-E-Y. But what they have done is they have said, you know, if you just fight on the regulation turf, you're on their turf. He says what they've done is in many communities around the country actually change the laws that says corporations can't do whatever they want. And it's again, like what you're talking about, everything we're talking about here is radical. And what I mean by that is the original meaning of radical is having to do with the root.
Yeah.
And when you start dealing with root causes, that's truly radical. And that's what we're talking about here. I'm talking with Chuck Collins. I'm Terrence McNally. His book is 99-1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. You can learn more at inequality.org. Okay, let's turn to solutions. One of the things that you point out is, as we talked about before, we've been through this before and we're able to make changes. So that's one of the things that gives you confidence. If we begin the solution conversation, where does that start?
Well, I think part of it is a recognition that because wealth is so concentrated in so few hands, we need to sort of float some pretty bold solutions. When people talk about inequality and how to solve the problem, they say, well, first we should raise the floor. We should do what Europe does to establish a safety net through which people will not fall, have a decent minimum wage, have basic vacation, health leave policies, just things that ensure that all workers have a basic minimal standard.
So first kind of rule changes, raise the floor.
Raise the floor, standards, safety net. The second group of rule changes are things that people call like level the playing field. And important within that is, say, campaign finance reform. Don't allow a big company to dominate the political rule writing process through their campaign donations. Let's have campaign finance reform.
Let me just point out one of the things, a statistic I read recently was that basically 196 people have been the primary contributors to all those super PACs, and thus basically determining 196 people in a country of 350 million who is on top, who can afford the advertising. I mean, they're basically that small group is running things in terms of public perception in a way that's never been possible before.
That's astonishing statistic and believable, you know, because we can do those kinds of things, level the playing field, fair trade rules, corporate tax policies that don't, you know, penalize small business and preference large business. So you can level the playing field. But I would argue we can't actually address the huge, this inequality death spiral or this concentration of wealth will subvert campaign finance laws. So as long as the rich and these powerful companies have so much wealth and power, it's like water running down a hill. It's just gonna find a way around the rules. The only real solution is to break up concentrated wealth and corporate power, and that requires an agenda that is sort of not all on the table. I mean, it's clearly taxing the wealthy, taxing wealth transfers, inherited wealth, at levels that we have in the history of our country done, but revisiting that.
So some of the things that are on the table, the Buffett rule, which is, you know, I don't know when it's going to come up, but it's going to turn out, we assume it's not going to pass, but it's going to be out there. The Buffett rule, and then the other thing you were talking about, capital gains.
Yeah, treating income from wealth, taxing it at the same as income from work.
I've heard you suggest, yeah, just whatever we do with one, you know, if it's going to change in the income tax side, just make them the same.
Yeah, stop.
So that if I'm a wealthy person, there's no advantage to me over you if my income's investment and yours is through work.
Yeah, I mean, that's in some ways a core principle of fairness. Why is it that, you know, this is why Warren Buffett, you know, pays 17% of his income in taxes, because his capital gains are taxed at 15%, and his secretary, whose entire income comes from her wage income, is paying 28% or something like that. So that is a key kind of fairness issue. But I would argue that things like a financial speculation tax, a tax on Wall Street transactions, an inheritance tax on fortunes over $10 million.
Let me just take one more second on the speculation tax. A very, very small, I mean 0.1%, 0.01%, if there was a charge on every transaction, A, it raises a lot of money. B, it probably has some positive effects in terms of slowing down the margin, lowering the margin in this rapid transaction model that is perhaps more volatile than we need and only works for those who have access to that speed trading.
Yeah, I think you've made I don't have to say anymore. You've made the perfect case, which is, you know, it's $300 billion if we charge a penny on every $4 of transaction. We could generate a substantial amount of money that could provide the oversight for a healthy financial system, and we'd have some change left over to reinvest in converting to a healthy green infrastructure along the way.
My thought is take money from defense and add an investment tax and say that in terms of investment, we're going to invest in kids and clean tech. So there's investment that's obvious to anyone. And in terms of defense, we're going to redefine national security so that it has to do with education, infrastructure, access to things and so on. And then redesign healthcare and finance. I'm saying that's more radical. How would you redesign finance so that it actually, the original meaning of finance was to provide investment for people rather than to just be a way to make huge amounts of money?
Well, we do have a financial system that meets the actual credit needs of residents and localities and local businesses, and it's small banking and credit union sector. I think that my remedy is we have to break up the megabanks. The megabanks have become too powerful. Their market share has grown since the 2008 economic meltdown, as we as taxpayers have aided them in their process of consolidation. So the Bank of America's and the Wells Fargo's, they're just too big. They're not only too big to fail, they're now getting too big to save. And if one of those goes down, then its impact on the whole economy is disastrous. And they're using their power to weaken regulation and even weaken the pitiful Dodd-Frank financial reforms that were put in place 2 years ago. I mean, they're bad actors. And they are about, and unfortunately, they're really not about meeting the real credit needs of our real economy. So break them up. The next time there's any kind of bump in the road, we should use that as an opportunity to make the political case that they should be broken into much smaller pieces.
Would you agree, as Lawrence Lessig says, that campaign finance is the linchpin here? That you know, we had a crisis that you'd think could have led to a new deal, but it didn't. It led to a massaging sort of the things to keep things from exploding any further. That happened, but they ended up winning when at a point when they should have been changing.
That's right. I mean, how else can we explain the failure after 2008 to put in place real meaningful reforms with teeth? It's because of the corporate capture of our political system, because of the campaign finance system. I kind of think they have to sort of work like a little
parallel
in tandem, you know, because again, the big money is going to find its way around. We have to have
right.
reforms that are going to break up their power.
But what I'm saying is how will those reforms pass in a current politics where people basically, I mean, one of the things that I think is if people basically feel disconnected from politics and from government, and that's a bad situation because that leads to cynicism and resignation.
Absolutely.
So now in terms of changing the culture, a couple of things that you lay out, and one is you say we need three shifts. We need a shift in values. We need a shift in power, and we need a shift in rules. And then we need three kinds of shifts in rules. Raise the floor, level the playing field, break up the overconcentration of wealth and power. On your last two pages, I want you to actually read these, because I think this is where we come to at the end of all this. And this would be the I need to reveal down to the way forward.
Okay. I need to reveal one personal bias or belief that is rooted in my own spiritual practice. An important source of my optimism is our personal and societal capacity for transformation. Each of us has a tremendous internal ability to heal from brokenness, which will transform not just our own lives, but also the direction of our communities. We have the wherewithal to step up and respond to the crisis at a wartime mobilization level. In fact, I think each of us is waiting to be awakened and called forth to something fundamentally greater. I think there are millions of people around the world who are essentially half awake, sleepwalking through their days. But like a dormant seed waiting for the right conditions of moisture, we are waiting to be called forth. We could be called forth by fear and scarcity to hunker down, but there is just as much possibility that we'll be called forth to share community responses, which in the end is the only way forward.
Okay, and then you actually trump that almost with this last thing. I'd like to end this book with a personal invitation to you to explore what it means to step up, if you would.
Yeah, I invite you to put this book down and pause, sit quietly and think about the coming years and what role you will play in the changes ahead. Think of one or two people with whom you could talk about the changes ahead and make plans. These challenges may feel overwhelming, but you can start small and manageable with one-on-one conversations. And I should say that comes out of my own experience of being part of an affinity group and also something called a resilience circle, people basically coming together to read and talk and have the kind of conversation you and I are having, but with a group of people, and then saying, how can we help one another? We are heading into an economic transition that's both economic and ecological.
Yeah, the point, I want to read one sentence, and then I think I've got to almost go to the close, which is, this is a sentence very critical in the book. We must not only press for policies to reduce inequality, but also make a nimble transition to a new economy based on an entirely different model of economic growth. So it isn't just like in the early 20th century. We don't just need to reduce inequality. We have to do it at the same time as we change our model of how money is made, what prosperity is, and how we relate to the earth and the rest of society. We've got to wrap it up. But those things about resilience, those things about affinity groups, that's in this book, because what Chuck Collins is talking about is a generational task ahead of us. It's not a quick fix. It's get together with your neighbors and slowly but surely take this Occupy 99% awakening and change the way things are done in this country. The book is 99-1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. You can learn more at inequality.org. You can also sign up there for a weekly digest called Too Much. And finally, thank you to Chuck Collins. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Terrence.